So next Sunday is the Feast of Christ the King, which is the end, of course, of the liturgical year. And so we've kind of worked ourselves, presumably, into that by these readings last Sunday and this Sunday, which are all from the 25th chapter of Matthew's Gospel, all of which deals with the end time, the judgment. The Jews had this notion that their lives were really going to be assessed. And that this problem became very particular in the case of these Jews who followed Jesus, because they believed that Jesus was going to come back right away, and he didn't. And so by the time Matthew wrote his gospel around the year 85 or so, they had to make major accommodations. And as we saw last week, they did by making up that story about the 10 ladies with the oil lamps. And today is another instance of the same thing, only with a slightly different angle. The problem, of course, is that the Master God does not send Jesus back right away, and so people just kind of lay back on their oars and do nothing. And so, either most likely Matthew made up this story, or maybe Jesus told it in a different context, to point out that you have to live your life. You have to live your life. And this notion of talents, by the way, was a denomination of money, a very large one, as a matter of fact. So it's not talents as we typically understand that. So what's going on here is the constant restatement that life or reality is not finished. We are on the way to some point which has yet to be reached. I really believe, as I proposed last week, that we human beings are hell-bent for stability and permanence and eternality. You know, we want something to just stay put. We want to have arrived. We want perfection. And I think probably the leverage for that insatiable appetite is our insecurity about the future. We don't know what's going to happen. So we want it done right now. We want who we are done. We want our jobs done. We want all this permanence. And I said last week with the parable of those 10 ladies that we could look at that as reminding us that everything in life is provisional. Provisional. It doesn't mean that everything's going to be wiped out, but it is provisional. This is a kind of sketch for what's going to be. And I think you could look at this parable today and say what we're being reminded of is that everything in life is unfinished, basically. I mean, the guy who received the one talent was basically a coward. One Matthean scholar called him mouse-minded. Mouse-minded. He got the money, he said, I'm getting nervous, I'm a coward, so I better, you know, this guy's tough, and so I better go, you know, make sure that he gets everything back. So he risks nothing. He sits on his thumbs and does nothing. He's finished. Well, these other two people got all this money and then managed to double it. And you notice, it's an interesting thing also that he didn't ask the guy who got less money than the guy who got more money, why didn't you make more money? No, one of the nice things about this text is that everybody is unfinished, but everybody is different and has a different sort of unfinishedness in their life, too. And so you don't make nasty comparisons. My brother, you know, had a 5-year plan, and now he's got a law degree and is practicing and is very successful in Toronto, blah, blah, blah. No, you don't do that kind of stuff. You don't happen to be your brother. So, in that light, I would like to suggest that I was sort of paralyzed when I prepared over the week and saw that they had done this thing from Proverbs about the good wife. What I'd like to suggest is this was chosen ironically. Because if you look at the rest of the book of Proverbs, women are always the great temptresses, which men have to be on the lookout for. And women are inferior beings. And therefore, if you get a good one, it's quasi-miraculous. You know? What I'm suggesting is that they put this in the liturgy, because they say, that's a tribute to our unfinishedness, because if we still look at women that way, we badly need to move on. Get on with it. I think that's a quite reasonable reading of this choice. But everything is unfinished. Everything is unfinished. And of course, the religious corollary of that is everything is unfinishable, because it's God and I who are going to finish things. I want to do it all by myself. I want to say, I've arrived, or this is done. And this, of course, is eminently true, not just of us human beings, of the church, too. So I'd like to do something I don't think I've ever done before, which is to read a sizable portion of an article that was published in the Tablet for October 19th. The Tablet is, I think, the best English-language Catholic magazine in the world. It's published in England. Some of you may have heard John Wilkins, its editor, speaking at King's last year on his way to Windsor to get an honorary doctorate there. So he published two articles on the Vatican Council. Because the Vatican Council was basically called, if you remember the speech that John 23rd gave at the beginning of it, to point to, we're not there. We are terribly unfinished. We are terribly unfinished. Get on with it. Was the whole message of the council. And of course, there's been enormous amount of commentary that movement has been stopped dead, or virtually dead. For example, the First Vatican Council had as its major output the definition of papal infallibility. Then the war came in Europe and all the bishops had to go home, so they couldn't finish up a bunch of other stuff. And out of that, of course, arose this near papalatry, and the centralization of power and authority in the papacy, in the Bishop of Rome. And every other bishop ends up being, as they describe themselves, in safe quarters, as errand boys of the bishops. So clearly, Vatican II attempted to redress that, to say, well, the Pope is a bishop, but he's a bishop with other bishops, and they got to work together. And this doesn't mean that the Pope says, you guys go do this, and they say, okay. But rather, they have the synods of bishops. European, the African, the Oriental bishops would meet. And so I just want to read Wilkins' description of what happened when the bishops of India came to the Vatican as an instance of this resistance to an awareness that we are not finished. So Wilkins writes, the trouble with journalists is that they want to know what's really going on. Attending the Asian or Oceanian synods, the bishops of Asia, of Oceania, for example, they note the consistent pleas of some of the bishops for the ordination of married men to be considered in some circumstances. So this has been urged by those bishops for a long time. Then they find out that the final lists of propositions sent to the Pope from those synods to help him compose his concluding document contain no reference at all to any such ordinations. How come? Some time ago, a letter was published in the Tablet which answered that question. It was written by a former vicar general of the Mill Hill Missionaries, John Wingard, who had spent 13 years experience in India. The letter recounted how his friend, "Father, Amalur Pavadas, who died later in a car crash, had felt, quote, frustration and anger, end quote, after the 1974 Synod on Evangelization under Pope Paul VI. Amalur Pavadas was one of India's best-known theologians and a leader in the Indian Catholic Church. His brother, Cardinal Lurdaswamy, was the Archbishop of Bangalore. He served as one of the two special general secretaries to the Synod, at which the relator, the moderator, happened to be Karl Wojtyla, then Archbishop of Krakow, currently the Bishop of Rome, as you know. When he got back to India from Rome, he poured out his heart to Wingards. Amalur Pavadas told Wingards that on arrival in Rome, he went to the Synod office. There, he found shelves upon shelves of consultation documents, because before they had these things, they send out stuff to the bishop and say, what do you guys want to talk about? Sent in by the national bishop conferences from around the world. But little of this original material had been used by the Vatican Committee that prepared the basic discussion papers for the Synod. After the individual speeches, which occupied the first phase of the proceedings, the participating bishops separated out as usual into discussion groups. Now they opened up new avenues, Amalur Pavadas said. But when it came to compiling the final document, at that time the bishops themselves still wrote it, this material was largely dropped. And a text that had already been prepared in advance by the papal civil servants was presented as the synthesis of the bishop's suggestion. So the curial officials had already written the paper that they were going to do so all these guys could sit and run their mouths endlessly, and it wouldn't make any difference. Because they knew, they were finished. Amalur Pavadas was appalled and protested. At this, he was summoned to the office of the two cardinals who were most responsible for directing the synod. In response to his objections that the supposed synthesis of the bishop's wishes did not represent what the bishops themselves had said, he was told to comply, phrase, in quotes, for the good of the church. Who knows what's the good of the church? Only people who already have a finished idea of what the church ought to be. He said that he could not, in conscience. He was then told by the leading cardinal of the two, "Do you realize this means that you will never be made a bishop?" Amalur Pavadas was determined not to give up. The doctored document was to be presented to the synod next morning. He scoured Rome for typewriters and photocopiers and set about preparing an alternative one based on the true interventions and conclusions of the bishop's working groups. The work went on through most of the night. Then he went to meet leading cardinals, archbishops, and bishops, giving them copies of his alternative document and explaining what the curia was intending to do. He got a shock. Many of them, though upset to hear about the Vatican's plans, were not willing to challenge it. Does this sound like the guy in the parable with the one talent who stuck it in a hole? A few bishops, however, did speak out at the plenary meeting next morning. I'm almost finished. The result was that the session was suspended and the synod did not adopt a document at all. Instead, 2 years later, Paul VI produced his apostolic exhortation, Evangelii Nuntiandi, which is one of the finest texts of his pontificate. It seems as though the small rebellion by a core group of bishops had paid off, but the Roman Curia was the real winner. Since that synod, it has been assumed that no synod of bishops can produce its own text. They now submit confidential, secret propositions to the Pope, who in due course writes and issues the final document, which may or may not incorporate much of the bishop's conclusions. Why did I read all this stuff? This is horrifying. Who runs the church? I mean, is the church finished? Is the church finished? You know, is the church a little sparkle in Cardinal Ratzinger's eyes, where he knows precisely what's going to happen, what ought to be done? Is this not what is going on today in the pedophilia thing? And Wilkins goes on with other indications from other synods. The question is, how seriously do we take this business of the finishedness or the unfinishedness of the world and of the church? Because we happen to be the church too. And if we just sit, folks, and countenance this stuff, then we're not much different from the guy who got his money, dug a hole, and stuck it in there too.